You've dialed up the NPR News Update for Thursday, January 9th. Thanks for doing so. I'm Phil Picardi. Coming up, Minsure still has its problems. We'll hear about the efforts to repeal a new business tax. What's in that road salt that goes into the state waterways? And a Minnesota author is getting a medal. First, Woodbury native Shazan Kazem returns to Minnesota today after being freed from the United Arab Emirates. He was jailed for 9 months for posting a video mocking youth culture in Dubai. Residents of North and East Metro communities last night got a chance to hear what the state's first groundwater management area might mean for them. Here's Matt Sepik.
The area includes a wide swath of the metro, where the Department of Natural Resources says groundwater is being used faster than it's being replenished. The DNR has the authority to limit pumping and force customers to reduce usage, but the agency is still studying how and where to do that and if it needs to be done. At a public meeting in Shoreview, DNR Commissioner Tom Landwehr said it's not a crisis yet, but future development needs to be planned with water use in mind.
We need to figure out how to anticipate future development, allow for continued growth, and have a sustainable supply of water into the future.
One possible solution the Met Council is considering is having suburbs that use well water switch their supplies, at least partly, to river water. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Minnesota Attorney General Lori Swanson has sued a Plymouth debt collection firm. The suit alleges the operation charged thousands of Minnesotans illegally high interest rates. Martin Moylan has more.
The debts are linked to overdrawn accounts with U.S. Bank and Wells Fargo that had been closed. Swanson says state law only allows a maximum of 6% interest on such debt, but Swanson says the debt collection firm drawing her ire, Bradstreet & Associates, would typically charge 22% interest.
In many cases, the lion's share of the original debt was not principal that people took from the bank, but these bank fees. So you're essentially paying 21.75% interest on many, many bank fees.
Swanson said the debt passed from the banks to Bradstreet through a middleman that buys and sells consumer debt. The attorney general said she's not alleging wrongdoing by the banks. Bradstreet could not be reached for comment. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Data from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety show Minnesota's brewery boom continued unabated last year. Here's Curtis Gilbert.
The state licensed 17 new breweries in 2013, even more than the year before. Beer-making operations popped up all over the Twin Cities, as well as Duluth, Moorhead, Cold Spring, and Goodview. Five breweries and brew pubs were licensed in Minneapolis alone last year. Statewide, there are now more than 60 licensed breweries. That number has tripled in the last 5 years. Most of the new breweries are taking advantage of Minnesota's 2011 Surly Bill. Nicknamed after the Surly Brewing Company, the law allows breweries to sell their beer on-site by the pint. Tap rooms, as they're called, can make small breweries financially viable. The law is widely credited with sparking the state's brewery boom. Curtis Gilbert, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Demand for workers picked up in Minnesota last month, so says reporter Annie Baxter.
Job listings posted on websites like LinkedIn and Monster.com spiked in December. The research group The Conference Board says employers in Minnesota listed about 6,000 more job openings online in December compared to November. Nationally, the number of ads was up as well. The Conference Board says demand for workers picked up considerably in the second half of 2013 after a flat first half of the year. The group says the supply of workers is nearing equilibrium with demand in Minnesota. There were 11 unemployed people for every 10 positions posted online last month. Nationally, it was more like 21 unemployed people for every 10 online job ads. The sign of rising labor demand coincides with a report from payroll processor ADP. It indicates that private sector employers added 238,000 jobs last month, more than analysts expected. Annie Baxter, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The University of Minnesota has named a new dean for its largest college. Alex Friedrich reports.
John Coleman will head the College of Liberal Arts beginning July 31st, pending approval by the Board of Regents next month. He comes from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he is chair of the Political Science Department. U of M officials say Coleman was able to reinvigorate his department after a wave of budget cuts it suffered before he became chair in 2007. He'll have a similar challenge in Minnesota. The College of Liberal Arts, which educates about half the U's undergraduates, has seen multi-million-dollar budget cuts since 2008. Coleman will take over for interim dean Raymond Duvall. The previous dean, James Parente, stepped down in June. Alex Friedrich, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Hennepin County shelters have taken in about 2,200 homeless families, single adults, and youth during this week's sub-zero cold. Hundreds more people slept in lobbies and other emergency centers. The county also opened a warming center for homeless youth. Mikkel Beckman directs the Minneapolis and Hennepin County Office to End Homelessness. He says Monday and Tuesday this week were especially difficult for families with school-aged children.
For children who don't have a home, that became a really challenging thing to find a place to be that was warm because they couldn't go to school and stay warm, didn't have a home to stay in. Over in Hennepin County, we do have enough shelter capacity for most of the populations except for homeless youth. And we also worry about families in suburban Hennepin County living in automobiles.
Beckman says one young man survived the night in Powderhorn Park. He eventually found a warm place to sleep. The Cedar Cultural Center in Minneapolis has announced a benefit concert for victims of a New Year's Day fire. Ewan Kerr has more.
The concert on Friday, January 24th, will feature West Bank legend Spider John Kerner, the Brass Messengers, and Martin Devaney, amongst others, with more performers to be announced soon. The fire at 515 Cedar Avenue South took the lives of three residents and destroyed the building, which contained a grocery store and 10 residential units. The building, now demolished, stood just yards from the Cedar Cultural Center, which regularly hosts concerts from major U.S. musicians and performers from around the world. In a release from the Cedar, Executive Director Rob Simons says community groups in the area agreed this was a chance to unite the neighborhood in the face of tragedy. Tickets for the All Ages show go on sale Friday. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
It's the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. MinSure's interim CEO and its board chair face a grilling from state lawmakers about the troubled health insurance website today. The two go before a legislative oversight committee. The hearing takes place with the online health insurance marketplace under fire from frustrated consumers, an unhappy governor, and an increasingly critical legislative auditor. Elizabeth Stawicki reports.
The Legislative Oversight Committee's co-chairman, Representative Joe Atkins, a DFLer from Invergrove Heights, says the hearing has a full agenda with lots of questions.
We're going to look at some of the IT issues, the call center wait times. There was some security issue that was identified about a month ago that apparently has been resolved, but we want to hear that directly from the person that found it.
Atkins says the committee will also hear from a couple of happy MinSure customers who found better coverage at a lower price than they'd pay before. But positive stories about MinSure have been far and few between, particularly against a chorus of complaints from other angry, frustrated consumers who have been stuck in the MinSure application system or subjected to hours on hold. Equally vocal about his disapproval, Governor Mark Dayton has pointed his sharpest criticism at IBM Curum, one of MinSure's software contractors. This past weekend, techs took the website down in order to improve it. MinSure's interim CEO Scott Light says improvements in the past week have dislodged about 1,100 consumers who were stuck in the process. And while he says the site continues to improve daily, Light acknowledges only half a dozen of 21 problems the governor specified to IBM Curum have been fixed. The big question is whether MinSure will work as promised before the end of March, the deadline when Minnesotans must obtain coverage or face a penalty under the health care law. Light says it still won't work seamlessly by then.
So when I say that we are probably not going to have a perfectly functioning site by March 31st, that means that we're going to have to make sure that we have ways for people to get into coverage by March 31st.
Meanwhile, MinSure announced updated numbers yesterday showing that about 72,000 Minnesotans have signed up for coverage as of year end. That's up about one-third from December 24th. Despite the MinSure website's problems, Light still encourages Minnesotans to use the site. But he says MinSure is bringing back an alternative for those still having trouble, paper applications that staffers will enter into the system by hand.
We're going to create manual processes to process them through in a paper way because the important thing in our mission here is to get people into health coverage.
To get more answers about what went wrong when, MinSure announced it's contracted with a company called Optum, a subsidiary of UnitedHealth, to determine the depth of the online insurance exchange's problems. Optum will perform the analysis free of charge, with preliminary results available next week. Until then, the role of Minsure's IT vendors is sure to come up during the oversight hearing. Representative Joe Atkins is supplying members with a statement from vendor Maximus.
Unsolicited, I got a call from Leslie Wolf, who's, I believe, the regional president for Maximus, just kind of outlining what the chronology of their involvement was. And she wanted to have an awareness among members of the commission, so I asked her to place those comments in a summary to provide to me, and then I'd provide to members of the Oversight Commission.
The summary says Minsure's initial $41 million contract established Maximus as the lead vendor, leading other tech firms in designing and development. But for a reason not detailed in the summary, it says Minsure staff essentially took over Maximus's role in developing and leading the project last February. It asserts Minsure changed the approach for establishing the system's requirements.
Elizabeth Stewicki for us. State revenue officials have come out with additional details about how a controversial new warehousing sales tax will work when it's set to take effect on April 1st. But as Tim Pugmire reports, the clarifying guidelines also appear to be adding more fuel to the campaign to try to repeal it.
The Minnesota Department of Revenue guidelines come 7 months after lawmakers passed the sales tax that will apply to any business buying storage or warehouse services from another entity. A business will not be taxed for the use of storage facilities that it owns. State Revenue Commissioner Myron Franz said the tax specifics were developed with the help of business owners and farmers.
The goal is to make sure that we provide as much guidance and detail to businesses and individuals as we can. I think one of the key elements we've heard time and time again from taxpayers is whatever the new rules are or whatever the changes are, please give us as much guidance as you can. Give us examples.
The listed examples of taxable services include the storage of non-digital documents, coal, hazardous waste, lumber, liquor, and general goods. The exemptions are agriculture products, refrigerated storage, electronic data, self-storage services, and petroleum products. Franz said the tax will raise an estimated $95.4 million over the remainder of the current budget cycle. Many business owners have been fighting against the warehousing tax since it was first proposed a year ago. Richard Murphy, president and CEO of the Minneapolis-based company Murphy Logistics, said the new guidelines describe a tax that is even broader and more onerous than he expected.
Most of us had the impression that the storage aspects of warehousing would definitely be covered, but they have gone on to include what they're referring to as other services, which is often referred to as, they say, logistics services. So they are basically taxing every aspect of the warehousing industry in Minnesota.
Murphy said the specifics of the ag exemption were also disappointing. The storage of raw products like wheat, feed corn, and vegetables won't be taxed, but modified products like cheese, flour, and sugar will. Beth Cadoon, Director of Tax and Fiscal Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, said she too thinks the warehousing tax goes too far. Cadoon said a repeal is needed before April 1st to prevent further harm to businesses.
We have already heard from companies that have had to make decisions with some of their customers saying that if this tax were to take effect, that they won't be able to do business in the state. We've heard from some companies that because of that have had to expand outside of the state already.
Cadoon is working on the Chamber's campaign to repeal the warehouse tax and two other business sales taxes that lawmakers passed last year. The others, which took effect in July, apply to equipment repair and telecommunications. DFL Governor Mark Dayton has said he wants to get rid of the taxes if the state economic forecast still shows a sufficient budget surplus in February. But DFL Senate Tax Committee Chair Rod Skoy of Clearbrook said he isn't ready to make the same commitment.
It will be discussed within the legislative process as to where best to go, and the governor will have his say as to what the final outcome is because he's going to sign the bill. So I'm not committing today that this is the top priority.
Both both Skoy and DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach of Cook said their preference is to use surplus revenue to bolster the state budget reserves. The 2014 session begins February 25th.
Tim Pugmire at the state capitol. Minnesota dumps a lot of salt on the roads during the winter, and that salt goes into our lakes, streams, and wetlands. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Brooke Oslison is Watershed Project Manager. She talked about that issue with Kathy Werzer.
We pour a lot of salt on roads, sidewalks, and parking lots, as you know. We've been doing this for years. How much damage is being done to our water?
Well, the chloride part of salt is what is particularly harmful to aquatic life. And at high enough levels, it can actually be toxic to fish and insects living in our lakes and wetlands and streams.
Do we know how many waters, lakes, rivers are impaired in Minnesota because of chloride?
Yes. Currently, we have 44 waters in the 7-county metro area that are higher than the state's water quality standard for chloride.
Is it mostly a metro area problem?
Yes. There's really no other source of salt to our waters than road salt. So it's mostly an urban, very high road density problem where we see these higher chloride concentrations in our waters.
Ultimately, if this goes unchecked, what can happen?
Well, the issue with chloride is that it's 100% soluble. So once that chloride is in the water, it will flow to wherever the water is, and it's a permanent type of a pollutant. It's not going to degrade over time or be taken up by any plants or organisms. So the chloride is just going to continue to build up in our lakes and wetlands and streams over time if we don't start to limit our use of salt.
Well, we still have an issue with icy roads in the metro, and MnDOT gets out there and does a good job trying to treat the roads. But are there ways to minimize the use of salt?
Absolutely. We have had really great success in being able to reduce the amount of salt that folks are putting down. In some cases, cities, counties, or MnDOT have put at least 50% less down than what they were and have been able to provide the same level of safe roads that they were at the previous rate.
Are homeowners an issue in this, too? You can buy, of course, at hardware stores and other stores, more environmentally friendly de-icers and that kind of thing. Does that seem to work, or is there another alternative to that as well?
Well, the best defense for homeowners is really to get out and mechanically remove that snow as soon as possible. Some of these storms, it's impossible because we get this sleet, you know, very wet, dense snow, and then it gets to freezing temperatures almost instantly, it seems like. But really getting out and shoveling and mechanically removing that snow is the best option for homeowners and for, you know, the plow drivers as well. If we can get out there early and prevent compaction from happening, prevent that ice from bonding with the pavement, we'll likely be able to keep those surfaces a little bit safer. You know, this is a very complex issue because, as you said, there's so many different users of salt. We have homeowners putting it down. We have private applicators putting it down at our shopping malls, our dentists and doctor's offices, as well as the cities, counties, and, of course, the state that are using this for public safety.
Brooke Oslison, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Ms. Oslison spoke with Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition, and so did Kate DiCamillo. She is the Minnesota author. In her latest book, A Squirrel Gets Transformed into a Superhero. Tomorrow in Washington, D.C., it's DiCamillo's turn to transform into an ambassador. The Library of Congress has named her National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. DiCamillo is the author of several books for young people, including The Tale of Despereaux, which won the highest honor for children's literature, the Newbery Medal.
Do I call you what, Madam Ambassador now?
I don't know. I'm just so absolutely delighted by your introduction because I'm thinking of myself as a squirrel who's been transformed. I loved that.
What is your agenda as an ambassador for young people's literature?
Agenda makes me nervous. You use the very word that I want to focus on as I do this, which is joy. I just want to remind people about the absolute joy that can be had from reading books and mostly from reading books together is what I would like to focus on. So grandparent reading to grandchild, teacher reading to classroom, child reading to parent. That's what I would really like to hone in on and just remind people about that joy.
Is that the connection that you and I have talked about, how people can connect through stories?
You are singing my song. Yeah, so when I do this, I'm supposed to have a platform, which does sound kind of like an agenda, right? But it's not. And my platform is that stories connect us. And I believe in that so much that it's an easy thing for me to go around and talk about.
But what does the connection mean to you?
It means that my mother read to me. It means that my teachers read to me. And it means that those stories and sharing those stories with somebody else changed the course of my life. And I think it can do that for other people too.
So if we're talking about getting people to connect through stories and reading more, say you're talking to a teenager and you know that that's kind of a tough audience. What's your best argument to them for picking up a book instead of, a video game or surfing around with their smartphone?
You know, I'm not going to, I don't want to say, hey, don't surf around on your smartphone. I surf around on my smartphone. But I just want to say equal time, you know, pick up the phone, but also pick up the book and that the book can help you. This whole thing with connection, you through stories you can connect to other people, but it also helps you find yourself when you read a story. So if there's anybody that needs to connect with themselves, I think it's a teenager, and you can do that through story. I believe that.
I know you usually travel with at least one book. So what did you pack for your trip to D.C.?
I have it right here beside me. I picked it up in the airport, which is one of the pleasures, is going in there and looking in the bookstore and getting a book before I get on the plane. It's by Helene Wecker, which is spelled W-E-C-K-E-R, and it's called The Golem and the Genie. She actually went to Carleton College, I see, on the back of this, and she looks very young. It's great. I love it.
All right. Say, is this going to distract you from your own writing to travel around the country for a couple years?
To me, it sounds like the ideal balance. I'll be home quite a bit. I can work on the novel that I'm working on, and then I will also get to go out and meet people. So long periods at home, short trips out, long periods at home, beating my head against the desk, trying to write a book, and then out on a plane.
The Library of Congress, Kate DiCamillo, is calling tomorrow an inauguration for you into this new role. What will happen? Will this be a real Tony event? Do you have any idea what to do?
I only know a few things. One, I have to give a speech. Two, I have to wear a dress. And three, I get a medal.
I wonder what's harder, getting the medal or wearing the dress? I've never seen you in a dress before.
Exactly. You haven't. You have not. The dress is very intimidating for me. The speech will be intimidating as well. And then there's a childlike part of me that's very excited about the medal.
Kate DiCamillo, congratulations. It's going to be a fun trip, I think.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to do this.
Kate and Kathy on Morning Edition this morning on Minnesota Public Radio News and here on the NPR News Update. Thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm Phil Picardi, Big John, with the Friday News right back here tomorrow.